I think I ought to start my little talk about Albury with some events which occurred before I was able to remember anything. My father came to Albury about 1908, when the estate was still enjoying active development. The estate's properties at that time, before the First World War, covered most of Albury and much of Chilworth. The reason for my father coming to Albury was that he worked for Belshaws of the Strand, London, at the time, and Belshaws had been commissioned by Albury Estate to install an electric generating plant and all the associated equipment. As was the practice at this time, when plant of this nature was to be installed in an area where there were no local labour conversant with running the new plant, Belshaws left an engineer with the newly installed plant to oversee the start of the works. Very frequently in these cases, the engineer stayed on, and so it was with my father. At this time, electricity was practically unheard of in country areas. Before the end of the First World War, my father had served in the Royal Flying Corps, lost his first wife and family, and had his home moved. He married again, and I was born on February 1920, the first son of this second marriage. There was much speculation about my continued existence, despite the efforts of the village midwife and the local GP, Dr. Davison. Nevertheless, I was born in Weston Yard, Albury, in the house now occupied by Mrs. Etherington, in what might be called the centre bedroom. This house had been built and previously been used as stabling for 5 horses, but had been used for human dwelling by at least one other family, a Mr. and Mrs. Miles, no relation to Mr. Miles the butcher that I know of, before my father took up residence. If you are ever favoured with a peek inside this charming cottage as it is today, you will find little resemblance to the way it was when I was young. In all fairness, the cottages built by the estate in the late 19th century were fine examples of the builder's profession, but it was my father's lot, in keeping with others, to have a farm building which had received a minimal amount of conversion. Some of the traces of former usage for farm purposes were looked upon with pride among us young lads. It was a case of who had most harness hooks or hayloft trap doors. But some of the features were somewhat less creditable, like the unplastered stone walls with their meagre coat of whitewash on the stones. In the thick walls which had been better dressed on the outside than the inside. My mother, who had seen and worked in some of the best houses in the country, spent many years trying to obtain a painted finish to the walls. She cajoled and prevailed upon the agents of the estate for materials, and must have cost the estate a bomb in paint alone. Another improvement that she managed to get done was the extension in depth of the stable-type windows, both to offer more light and to afford us the opportunity to see out. One feature not attended to during our time was the sloping stable-type floor in a room we would now call a utility room. My mother wanted to use it as a kitchen. The sloping surface was originally to permit drainage of effluent, although the cobbles had been skimmed with cement. We enjoyed at least 2 benefits, which were way above the norm for cottages at that time. Firstly, we were allowed the use of a minimal amount of electricity for lighting. This concession, the result, no doubt, of the nature of my father's employment. The other distinct benefit was a water closet, a luxury unheard of among cottagers. The previous occupants of our home had had to make do with a dry closet situated about 100 yards distance from the house, on the other side of the pigeon house. This arrangement must have caused them considerable stress at times. It was some years before I was to revert to the dry closet situation, both of the self-empty type and of the communally collected type. It is not so very many years ago that the last of these that I knew of finally disappeared. The communal collection was carried out in the village late in the evening by estate workers, and caused much comment from us young lads as the cart and contents slowly made its way round the village. So far as I remember, the contents were disposed of over farmland. The previously mentioned privileges caused some strong feelings among those who were less fortunate. It should be said that apart from feelings of envy, there were those who claimed that humus was good for the garden and that electricity was the devil's concoction, rejected by some even when it became available to all in about 1930. Although we tend to refer back to the disadvantages, I lived at a good time and enjoyed a good home. I started school at Albury a few weeks after my 5th birthday. There were no facilities for the average person's children to enjoy any introductory classes, and few parents were either able or aware of preschool preparation. Some were. Those children were able to read better at the age of 5 or 6 than some of those who left at 14. The bright ones were soon away to other schools where their abilities were better catered for. There were 3 classrooms, infants, middle and a top class, each with about 25 to 30 children. The headmaster at this time was Mr. Greenalge. In Weston Yard alone at one time there were as many as 12 children of school age, only 2 of which travelled to other schools. The elder girls had quite a maternal responsibility during our first months at school, and it was only after their influence had faded away that we found ourselves getting into troubles at school and home, varying from lateness or late and dirty, having done a climber's traverse of the banks of the Warren. On one occasion, things got rather serious, and a group of us walking across the heath found a live match. It was not long before a serviceable discarded box was also found. We were made. We could have a nice little bonfire. Such was our ignorance that to ensure success, we gathered plenty of dry grass and stacked it under a gorse bush. It was hot and dry as only heathland can get, and when the match was struck, the speed which the flames went up and over our heads frightened us near to death. We took flight towards the school. As the plume of smoke and flames grew, the look on our faces, I imagine, left no doubt as to who the guilty ones were. The fire was got under control, mainly by estate forestry men, and was confined to the triangle of heath next to the bungalow and outbuildings. The buildings were very much at risk. We had a visit during the afternoon from the local constable, and we were a frightened group of 6-year-olds. Later in our school life, we were able to make amends. As fires were not at all uncommon, and sometimes we were called on to help fight the fires. For lads with a turn of hand to practical things, there were many jobs around the school which varied from digging oak tree stumps from the school garden to erecting playground seats, cycle garage, etc. This did a world of good to our academic achievements. But as boys, contemplating a job of work within a year or so, we lapped it up. I'm going to backtrack a little now and mention a few things way before my time which affected our way of life. Albury, as we know it, must have received quite a boost in its development as a result of Drummond's eviction of the village from the park, and later building of cottages by the Duke, many of them bearing his crest and the date. Apart from various small builders, the estate operated their building from Weston Yard, which had previously been much more of a farm. When I was born, there was still much evidence of this building activity. All the buildings at this time, which were not converted for habitation, were converted into workshop or stores usage, with all trades represented. There was very little dependence on outside supplies. Albury is well situated for many basic building materials, including building sand and sand for bricks, chalk for lime and some stone, timber for structure and finishing, all near to hand. It must be remembered that transport and power for moving and working materials was still very much muscle power in those days. Despite this, the transfer to labour-saving machines was not always looked upon favourably. A number of incidents with machines caused raised eyebrows. The electric generating plant was installed in the old mill, which had just been vacated by Messrs. Botting. Electricity was generated from both a water turbine and a gas engine. The water turbine was installed in the same position that the water wheel had previously occupied when driving the flour mill. The turbine was considered more suitable for generating, as it ran at a higher speed and was more efficient, the water being in a sealed system from top to bottom stream level. To exploit the full power available, it needed to be run as many hours of the day as possible. This was seldom fully achieved, however, as the turbine required a steady flow of water, and if the seal in the column of water in the turbine was allowed to be broken by interruption of flow, all sorts of problems occurred due to loss of power. Looking at the stream today, one would think that it ran fairly constantly, but one had then to cope with interruptions, both natural and human. On windy autumn days, keeping the gratings clear of leaves was a continuous job, not aided by the practice of mill owners to dump their rubbish downstream rather than clear it away. This debris also needed clearing, and another practice of mill owners was to hold up the flow of water to suit their own convenience. So much for free power. The accent on its usage became more intense with the competition of mains electricity. In good conditions, the power rating of the turbine was about 10 horsepower. The turbine, as I mentioned, was supplemented by a gas engine made by Ruston and Proctor of Lincoln and rated at 13 horsepower, driving a separate dynamo. Before we get carried away, we consider this to be an easy alternative to running the turbine during difficult times. We must consider that there was no gas supply in Albury and no bottled gas available at that time. Like so many things at that time, if you wanted something, you made it. A philosophy that has rubbed off on me a bit. Anyway, the answer was to run a producer or suction gas plant. This was no soft option, as before any wheels could turn, the mucky business of heating suitable coals to produce the gas and subsequent cleaning of it before it could be used in the engine. Mercifully, town gas was used as soon as it became available in the village, but this was used as sparingly as possible. The mill used to house that electricity plant and provide free power is situated over a mile away from the park house, where most of the energy was used. As the system ran on 110 volts for all household requirements and had the disadvantage of voltage drop due to it being direct current, it called for constant vigilance, particularly during times of heavy load, when the Duke and Duchess were in residence, and particularly on dark winter nights or when parties were held. Notice was not always given when this was to happen. Then as the evening wore on, the lights would get dimmer. There was something to be said for our having our house on the same system, as ours also got dim, although not to the same extent as the park house, as we were nearer to the electric plant. At the first sign of dimming, my father had to make adjustments, no matter what the time of day or night. And I too had a fair amount of running about on this account, and I was not on the payroll. The plant as supplied had a storage system in the form of about 140 large lead acid accumulators, situated on the first floor of the old mill, extra supports being required to carry their weight. The arrangement was such that two separate 110-volt systems were used for lighting, it being possible to couple both supplies together for the few small power requirements on the estate. So far as I can remember, the carpenter's shop had both an electric saw and an electric planer. There was an electric pump situated by the stream near the laundry in the park, which was used for water for the park house and sometimes for topping up the village supply reservoir in the warren. I believe there were also a few small motors on laundry machinery. If a number of these motors were run at the same time, they consumed a large part of the power available and little was left for recharging for overnight use. I mention the electric storage arrangement because with the supply being a double system and because of the need to keep essential needs supplied, it was sometimes possible to transfer energy from one system to the other. This was achieved with a balancer machine, which was essentially two motors and two generators, all coupled together in line, and wired one motor and one generator to each system, and could be switched to transfer energy either way, and so restoring a balance. If the older people reflect on how we first used our newfound electricity supply, we might recall that we only had one light point in maybe some of our rooms, and we can compare this with the norm today, where we have at least two light systems per room and perhaps a dozen outlets in a kitchen and not so very many less in other rooms. To some extent, so it was on the estate, particularly when heating and entertaining appliances became available. It must be said that these private plants were never able to supply space heating as we know it today. My father kept this system going until about 1949 without any increase in generating capacity, and in spite of competition from the more recently available mains electricity. I would mention that when I was working before the war in the centre of Guildford and with almost a stone's throw of the main generating station, the street lights went up and down with the movements of the machine table when we ran the large reciprocating machines at night. My next job was not much of an improvement in this respect. A new factory, but due to the prohibitive installation costs, there were no mains electricity. Once again, we made our own. If we ran our machines to full capacity on a cold day, we were in trouble. On reflection, I have an admiration for my old father, who got over 40 years' work out of this early form of electricity supply, generally to the satisfaction of his employer, and certainly with less interruptions to supply than we get today. On a personal note, my father, like a good many others, did not take kindly to work in the house, which of course caused some family stress. Imagine then the reaction when a call from the spinster housekeeper at the park caused him to stop whatever he was doing, no matter what the time of day, and fix it quick. It did not go down too well. The plumber. I mention this trade next as it has a slight similarity in that both have pipework and are mainly concerned with metals. Also, in this instance, both involved using water power. For obvious reasons, I can only relate things as I saw them as a young lad and without the closeness I enjoyed with my father's work. On the credit side, the plumber's shop was within sight of our windows, and Mr. Barber was an exceptionally good tradesman. He also put up with some of us young people extremely well, but got a bit irate when we messed up his work or materials. A few lads can cause a lot of damage on an outdoor lead cutting floor, which was situated in front of the workshop and used for cutting shapes or for roof jobs. The lead, being in rolls, was susceptible to damage. Among the many jobs that fell to the plumber, besides the normal iron or lead pipework, was the manufacture of chimney cowls of all sorts and sizes. These cowls were made by hand to work freely in the wind and to suit the conditions required for a particular chimney. They were all made without power tools and all were a credit to look at on completion. Reference has been made to water power before, but the plumber had an extremely demanding commitment in that it was he who saw to it that the pumps were kept running to supply the village with water. The pumps were situated near the bottom of Parker's Hill and at the bottom of New Road Hill. They were driven by water wheels and ran continuously. Lubrication was primitive and required daily attention, and the levels in the reservoirs needed to be checked. One of my jobs early in my apprenticeship was to help reinstall the wheel at the bottom of New Road Hill and assemble the rebored cylinders. This would have been about 1937. So far as I know, these pumps ran water-driven until the supply was taken over by the Water Authority. It must be remembered that piped water was a long time coming for some people. Most of Little London in about 1923, and finally in Little London 1942. I remember when the water supply to the school failed in about 1929. We were favoured with some well water from Mrs. Sherlock, who lived just down below the school. It seemed beautiful stuff to drink. Perhaps it was that we were thirsty. At the other end of the village, at Waterloo Ponds, the cottages had well water or springs. You could see the frogs swimming about in the shallow well that served the first two cottages beyond Vale End. We all learned at an early age that springs and wells were not to be tampered with. Life, if harder, was simpler. People who had no pipe water knew that the water in well or spring was what their next cup of tea would be made from. They certainly didn't need Greenpeace to tell them not to pollute it. The bricklayer and plumber and labourer. I believe I'm right in thinking that during the time that my father was engaged with the electrical installations and employed by Belshaws, he lodged with Mr. Jim Gadd. The one portrayed as a boy in that excellent picture of estate workers building the school house in 1895. A friendship resulted which lasted the rest of their lives. Mr. Gadd's father and uncle undoubtedly were leading lights in the Duke's building programme in the late 1800s. And when one looks at the standard of workmanship of even workmen's cottages at this time, one cannot fail to admire the standards maintained. A recent attempt by a well-meaning architect, when replacing the old and picturesque South Lodge, by including buttresses in the front elevation, went pathetically wrong. I believe these still stand as a monument to our inability today to produce a bit of classic decor. I'm told on good authority that if we wanted gauged arches like those portrayed on Albury School, they would have to be machined by modern factory methods as a set and put in place on site. The ones at Albury School were shaped and built on site and are a delight to see. I've heard that a bricklayer, Mr. Mant, when putting in the arch over the door onto the loading bay at the mill at Waterloo Ponds, went home dissatisfied with his efforts. He felt so strongly about his work that he went on the job exceptionally early the next morning, removed the offending arch and rebuilt it to his satisfaction before the working day began. Such was the pride of a true tradesman. This was on an industrial building in a position where it is hardly ever seen. The same man, I believe, is mainly responsible for the estate office brickwork, which is looked upon by some as the best bit of work of its kind in the area. I saw little of the bricklayers, as theirs is very much an on-site job, but the yard was the place where some of their materials were stored, and also the surplus items from the various jobs. These included a small stock of items such as standard bricks and tiles, and also the special ornate items. When one looks round today, there are buildings crying out in Albury for some of these items, but of course they are now long since gone. In the times I remember, the stacks were kept clear of rubbish and restacked about every other year. The timber trades. In spite of the extreme variation between the winning of timber from standing trees to the final manufacture of items by joiners and carpenters, the whole process prior to about 1920 seems to have been carried out on the estate, in the yard and workshops immediately to the south of my old home. A pit saw being worked in the low workshops, continuing from what in my time was the established carpenter's shop, situated just behind the abattoir. I mention this timber or carpenter's yard, as to us it was something of a no-go area. It was situated immediately behind our house and was something of a yard within a yard. The painters and the glaziers also operated from here, and the agent's office and the main stores led away from this yard. It was the place from which much of the direction of work took place. When I was about 5 years old, some trunks of trees of considerable size, about 4 foot 6 diameter, still lay about the yard near to this sawing and woodworking area. My parents seemed to consider these tree trunks, in one place reaching 5 to 6 feet high, a suitable backdrop for family portraits. One very big enlargement adorned our living room for many years. As far as I know, these large trees rotted away. In 1920, the estate mechanised their transport and conversion of round timber by investing in a Fowler traction engine and a large capacity Stenner and Gunn saw bench. This set was capable of being transported from one area to another, to minimise the haulage of very large trees. I'm told that it was first set up just inside the woods at park palings, opposite the almshouses. So far as I can ascertain, it was not too successful, and was fairly hastily shifted to a permanent situation in a covered mill at what was called the brickyard, where the saw still operates today. Over the years, I have had occasion to carry out work on this machine, and what I have seen indicates to me it saw a lot of work in its new situation, especially considering that sawing was not considered a year-round occupation. I recently worked in a very old farm cottage where a new floor was part of the work to be done. When I look at the pit-sawn oak flooring that was removed, the thought of the work involved in cutting all these boards by hand seemed phenomenal. As I have mentioned, the carpenter's area was not a place we were very welcome, but on the odd occasion, maybe escorted, we could see all the woodwork being carried out necessary to build and maintain the estate buildings. I believe that finer work was also carried out on furniture and fixings for the park house. The farmer. Although Albury was and still is considered an agricultural area, I have never been involved closely in this side of Albury life, and so I'll leave this topic to someone better informed than myself. I will, however, mention the work done by men and horses. The horses were prepared long before dawn and worked all the daylight hours during a large part of the year. There was very little protection as we know it today against bad weather. An empty corn sack thrown over the shoulders to soak up some of the rain being standard kit. I remember seeing Mr. Tulett going up and down all day long behind a plough in 10 acres, and then home to the farm as light was fading to look after the horses. I admire the work of these men, but I don't think that I was one of the same breed. Men with working horses did not get a lot of time off and precious little pay. Cottage gardens seemed almost obligatory, and even in my youth were considered a substantial contribution to the family's welfare. Most cottagers also kept allotments, which together with their gardens made a massive area of land to be worked and tended by hand. The social aspect of gardening was very evident. At the beginning of the season, just before Easter, the allotments were almost all being worked, evenings and weekends. Although the work at this time of year, digging and planting, was hard, there always seemed to be time for conversation and some merry banter. I will never forget a farmer who worked an allotment next to mine. In spite of the fact he could produce all the vegetables he wanted on the farm, he saw fit to join the other men growing their vegetables on the allotment. All I can say is his son did not continue this practice. Without today's choice of food, we tended to be governed by things being in season, with any change being the result of preserved fruit or vegetables. This was a time-consuming occupation for the lady of the house, who had no labour-saving equipment. Our parents spent much more of their time per day in providing for those needs of life which we take so much for granted today. Some of us may continue the practice of gardening, but we must surely admit that we do so by choice and not by any real feeling of necessity.